CBC Radio 2.
Now on Radio 2, the second in our series of Ian Fleming's James Bond stories. Damian Lewis reads part one of From a View to a Kill.
The eyes behind the wide black rubber goggles were cold as flint. In the howling speed turmoil of a BSA M20 doing 70, they were the only quiet things. Protected by the glass of the goggles, they stared fixedly ahead from just above the centre of the handlebars, and their dark, unwavering focus was that of gun muzzles. Below the goggles, the wind had got into the face through the mouth and had wrenched the lips back into a square grin that showed big tombstone teeth and strips of whitish gum. On both sides of the grin, the cheeks had been blown out by the wind into pouches that fluttered slightly. To right and left of the hurtling face under the crash helmet, the black gauntlets, broken-wristed at the controls, looked like the attacking paws of a big animal. The man was dressed in the uniform of a dispatch rider in the Royal Corps of Signals, and his machine was, with certain modifications, identical with a standard British Army machine. There was nothing to suggest that he was not what he appeared to be, except a fully loaded Luger held by a clip to the top of the petrol tank. It was 7 o'clock on a May morning, and the dead straight road through the forest glittered with the mist of spring. The road was the D98, and the motorcyclist had just passed beneath the Paris-Mont autoroute. He was heading north towards Saint-Germain, and there was no one else in sight in either direction except, perhaps half a mile ahead, an almost identical figure. Another Royal Corps dispatch rider. He was a younger, slimmer man. He was well on time, wondered whether to have his eggs fried or scrambled when he got back to HQ. 500 yards. 400. 3. 2. 1. The man coming up from behind slowed to 50. He reached down and unclipped the gun. The young man jerked his head round, surprised to find another dispatch rider on his run at that time of the morning. It might be anyone from the NATO nations that made up the staff of SHAPE. But when he recognised the uniform of the Corps, he raised a cheerful right thumb and cut his speed, waiting for the other man to drift up alongside. The man with the gun was 50 yards away. His face had set into blunt, hard, perhaps Slav lines. A single magpie flew out of the forest. The young man grinned and raised an ironical finger in self-protection. One magpie is sorrow. 20 yards behind him, the man lifted the Luger and fired one shot. The young man's hands whipped off his controls and met across the centre of his backward arching spine. His machine veered across the road and ploughed into a patch of grass and lilies of the valley. There it rose up on its screaming back wheel and crashed backwards on top of its dead rider. The killer executed a narrow turn and stopped. He walked in among the wild flowers, knelt down beside the dead man and brusquely pulled back an eyelid. Just as roughly, he tore the black leather dispatch case off the corpse and ripped open the tunic and removed a wallet. He wrenched a cheap wristwatch off the left wrist. The killer retraced his steps to the road, slowly scuffing leaves over the tire marks. He took extra trouble over the deep scars in the grass verge. The man heaved his machine off its rest and kicked down on the starter. Slowly, so as not to show skid marks, he accelerated away. Around the scene of the killing, the forest, which had held its breath while it was done, slowly began to breathe again. James Bond had his first drink of the evening. One cannot drink seriously in French cafes. Out of doors on a pavement in the sun is no place for vodka or whiskey or gin. No, in cafes you have to drink the least offensive of the musical comedy drinks that go with them. Bond always had an Americano. Bitter Campari, Cinzano, a large slice of lemon peel and soda. He always stipulated Perrier, for in his opinion expensive soda water was the cheapest way to improve a poor drink. A battered black Peugeot 403 pulled into double park at the curb. A girl got out and walked purposefully across the sidewalk. Bond sat up. She had everything, but absolutely everything that belonged in his fantasy. She was tall, and although her figure was hidden by a light raincoat, the way she moved promised that it would be beautiful. Before Bond could pull himself together, the girl had come up to his table.
"I'm sorry I'm late. You're wanted at the office."
She added under her breath,
"Crash dive."
Bond jerked himself back to reality. Whoever she was certainly from the firm. Crash dive was a slang expression the Secret Service had borrowed from the submarine service. It meant bad news. The worst. He said, "Right, let's go," and followed her to her car. She banged the gears into second and slid out into the traffic. Bond looked sideways at her. The blonde hair was silk to the roots. He said, "Where are you from?" "From the station. Number 765 on duty. Mary Ann Russell off." Wing Commander Rattray, head of Station F, was a fattish man with pink cheeks. He greeted Bond with relief. "Take a pew. There's a hell of a flap on and I've got to brief you and get you going. Somebody got our Dawn Dispatch rider yesterday, the weekly run from the Shape Intelligence Division. All the top gen. Took his dispatch case and his wallet and watch." Bond said, "That's bad. No chance it was an ordinary hold-up, or do they think the wallet and watch were cover?" "Shape security guess it was cover. 7 o'clock in the morning's a rum time for a hold-up. M says you're to get down there right away. You're to report to Colonel Schreiber. He's been handling the thing from the beginning. As far as I can gather, he's already done just about all there was to be done." Bond said impatiently, "What the hell does M expect me to do? Tell Shape security to do it all over again, but better? This sort of thing isn't my line at all. It's a bloody waste of time." Head of F smiled sympathetically. "Matter of fact, I put much the same point of view to M. Tactfully. The old man said you happened to be available and more or less on the spot. Said you had the sort of mind that might pick up the invisible factor." Bond laughed. He could see M's frown and hear the crusty voice. He said, "All right then, I'll see what I can do. Who do I report to?" "I'll make someone your duty officer. Russell can do it. She picked you up. Suit you?" "Yes," said Bond. "That'll be all right." Behind a door that said Colonel G.A. Schreiber, Chief of Security, Headquarters Command, was a ramrod-straight middle-aged American with greying hair and the politely negative manner of a bank manager. After cautiously amiable preliminaries, Bond said, "About this mess, at what speed did your man crash?"
"Between 20 and 40.
"What are you getting at, Commander?" "If your man wasn't trying to get away, and assuming he saw the killer in his mirror, that suggests that he accepted the man on his tail as friend rather than foe. That could mean some sort of disguise." "Commander..." There was an edge of tension in the voice. "We have, of course, been considering every angle of this case, including the one you mention, and I can tell you any man who can come up with an even remotely original idea on this will have to be closely related to Einstein." Bond got to his feet. "In that case, Colonel, I won't waste any more of your time. If I could just have the minutes of the various meetings to bring myself up to date..."
"Sure."
Bond said goodnight. As he walked along the corridor, he reflected that this was probably the most hopeless assignment he'd ever been on. If the top security brains of 14 countries were stumped, what hope had he got? Bond decided he would give it a couple more days, largely for the sake of keeping in touch with Mary Ann Russell for as long as possible, and then chuck it. Not two, but 4 days later, as dawn came up, James Bond was lying along the thick branch of an oak tree, keeping watch over a small, empty glade that lay deep among the trees bordering the D-98, the road of the murder. He was dressed from head to foot in camouflage. Even his hands were covered with the stuff, and there was a hood over his head with slits cut for the eyes and mouth. Even directly below the high branch, he could not be seen. The first 2 days at Shape had been the expected waste of time. On the morning of the third day, he was about to say his goodbyes when he had a telephone call from the colonel.
"Oh, Commander, the last team of police dogs got in late last night. Your idea that it might be worthwhile covering the whole forest."
"Sorry." The voice sounded unsorry, but absolutely negative.
"Oh." As much to annoy the colonel as anything, Bond said, "Mind if I have a talk with the handler?"
"Sure, sure."
The handler was a Frenchman. Bond met him at the kennels. He took Bond into the duty room. There were a couple of chairs and a table covered with a large-scale map of the forest.
"Our dogs covered it all, monsieur. There is nothing there."
The handler scratched his head.
We had quite a time getting them away from a clearing near the Carrefour Royal. They probably still smelled the gypsies.
Oh, Bond was only mildly interested. Who were these gypsies?
The handler pointed. This is the clearing, monsieur. There was a gypsy caravan there for most of the winter. They left last month. Cleans the place up all right, but for the dogs, their scent will hang about there for months.
Bond thanked him.
He got into the Peugeot and took the D-98 through the forest. When the Great Autoroute Bridge showed up a quarter of a mile ahead, Bond switched off the engine and coasted silently until he came to the Carrefour Royal. He stopped and got out of the car. 20 yards inside the trees, he came to the clearing. Bond walked round and gazed in among the roots, but there was nothing to see. On the edge of the road, there was a narrow passage between two trees. Casually, Bond bent to examine the trunks. He delicately scraped away a narrow sliver of caked mud. It hit a deep scratch in the tree trunk. There were 3 camouflage scratches on one tree and 4 on the other. Bond walked quickly out of the trees onto the road, pushed the car, jumped in, and only engaged the gears when he was well under the bridge. Now Bond was back in the clearing, above it, and he still did not know if his hunch had been right. It had been M's dictum that had put him on the scent. The invisible factor. The people who are so much part of the background that you don't know if they're there or not. Good cover, gypsies. Some of them had gone off in the caravan. Had some of them stayed, built themselves a hideout? Bond had thought he was building fantasies until he found the scratches. 6:30. Time for breakfast. Cautiously, Bond's right hand fumbled in his clothing and came up to the slit of his mouth. Bond made the glucose tablet last as long as possible and then sucked another. His eyes never left the glade. 2 wood pigeons that had been noisily courting among the thick grass started to make clumsy, fluttering love. A pair of hedge sparrows went busily on collecting bits and pieces for a nest they were tardily building in a thorn bush. It was the pigeons that gave the first alarm. With a loud clatter, they took off. Bond's heart began to thump. Something was moving among the roses. Inch by inch, a single thorny stem, an unnaturally straight one, was rising. It went on until it was a clear foot above the bush. Then it stopped. There was a solitary pink rose at the tip of the stem. Silently, the petals seemed to swivel and expand. The yellow pistils drew aside, and sun glinted on a glass lens the size of a shilling. Very slowly, the rose eye began to turn on its stem until the whole glade had been minutely surveyed. As if satisfied, the petals softly swiveled to cover the eye, and the single rose descended to join the others. Bond's breath came out with a rush. Gypsies! If that piece of machinery was any evidence, inside the mound, deep down in the earth, was certainly the most professional left-behind spy unit that had ever been devised. A shiver of excitement and anticipation, almost of fear, ran down Bond's spine. So, he had been right. But what was to be the next act?
Part 1 of From a View to a Kill by Ian Fleming was read by Damian Lewis and produced by Joanna Green. The executive producer was Liz Anstey, and it was a Senador production for BBC Radio 2. You can hear the concluding part at the same time next week.